So we've been thinking about the instructions which God gave to Moses for the tabernacle. And I've been making much in that connection of something that was said in chapter 25 and verse 8. Something God said there, these words, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst." And it's clear then from that verse that whatever else the tabernacle may be, most fundamentally, it's God's house. The tabernacle is God's house. And we're going to continue to view it very much in that light this morning. And my two headings then are two statements about God's house arising from the passage we're looking at this morning. And here's the first statement about God's house. Its composition, its fabric and supports. And this is chapter 26, verses 1 to 37. Its composition is fabric and supports. That is to say, it's a tent. It's a tent. This house which God wants to be erected for him, it's a tent. It's explicitly referred to as that several times in this chapter, and it's just very apparent anyway. While I don't want to scrutinize this morning every loop and clasp and tenon that's mentioned here, let me just walk you quickly through these specifications in chapter 26. So verses 1 to 14 are dominated by one word, curtains. And these aren't curtains of the kind that you might buy at Dunelm to draw across your windows at night time. No, these curtains are the tabernacle's walls. There are several layers of them. So in verses 1 to 6, we have an inner layer. It's the most delicate and aesthetically pleasing one. Verse 1, "Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen and blue and purple and scarlet yarns. You shall make them with cherubim skillfully worked into them." Then in verses 7 to 13, we have a second layer of curtain. It's less delicate and aesthetically pleasing. Verse 7, "You shall also make curtains of goat's hair." So toughness and durability are the name of the game with that layer. And then in verse 14, we have either one further layer or possibly two further layers. There's some debate about that. It's not really something that we need to lose too much sleep over, I think. But you get the point then. That word fabric in my first heading, it's no exaggeration. God's house truly is composed of fabric, these several layers of curtain. What about that other word in my heading, supports? Well, walls of fabric, of course, can't stand by themselves. They need supports to keep them in place. And that's what the next part of the chapter is about. The word dominating verses 15 to 30 is no longer curtains, it's frames. Frames, i.e. wooden supports for what would otherwise be floppy curtains. Verses 31 to 37 then wrap up the chapter, specifying actually two further pieces of fabric, two further curtains effectively, although that word isn't used. We're back indeed with that delicate, aesthetically pleasing material, blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine twined linen. So the first item in those verses is a veil. In verses 31 to 35, a veil that's to be made of this delicate, aesthetically pleasing material. So the tabernacle is to have two rooms, and this veil will be the partition between the two rooms. And then the second item in those verses 36 to 37, is a screen, as it's called. It's a door, essentially, at the point where the tabernacle will be entered. So that's it then. If your eyes are glazing over because curtains and frames and veils and screens are not really your thing, they can become unglazed again now. The walk through chapter 26 is over. But as well as perhaps testing your concentration skills, it has undoubtedly underlined one basic point, that this house then of God's is emphatically not a building with bricks and mortar. No, its composition is fabric and support. It's a tent. It's unmistakably and emphatically and unambiguously attend. That's what we're dealing with here. And that's a bit strange, isn't it? I mean, I said 2 weeks ago that it seems at first sight incongruous for God to dwell in such a material setting, a house that isn't made of fairy dust, but of earthy, physical, this worldly stuff. Well, we're discovering this morning that the incongruity is actually more acute than that, that it really is a material setting in the literal sense of that word, in which God is going to dwell. A house made of material, fabric. It's a tent. I mean, many of you would look down your noses at dwelling in a tent, even just for a week or two in your summer holiday. I'm not slumming it in some flimsy canvas hovel, you would say. I'm staying in a cottage, or at the very least, a caravan. And yet God, Moses is told here, is going to live in a tent. That's the kind of house that he's going to have. As I say, it seems strange. So what should we make of it? Well, there are doubtless many things that we could say, but I just want to flag up two principles to which I think this divine tent dwelling points us, two principles relating to God. And first of all, then, he's the God who delivers prematurely. He's the God who delivers prematurely. Now, you might be thinking, for goodness sake, Dan, why are you making such a big deal of God's house being a tent and how strange that is? It's not, in fact, remotely strange. It's just a practical necessity. The Israelites are traveling. They have to be able to carry God's house with them. It cannot, therefore, be some grand building, because how the dickens would they transport that across the desert? Only a tent meets the requirements of the situation. You might be thinking that. And in and of itself, that's true. If God is going to erect his house among the Israelites and be that welcoming host that we talked about last week, if he's going to do that while the Israelites are traveling through the desert, then yes, indeed, a tent is the only option. But this is the thing. Why should he erect his house among them and be a welcoming host while the Israelites are journeying through the desert? Why should he? That's not the deal that he had signed up to. It's certainly true that he had made promises about that kind of thing, about receiving the Israelites into his dwelling. He had spoken in that way. But those promises related to a particular stage in Israel's future. If you just flip back a few pages to chapter 15, you'll hopefully see what I mean by this. In chapter 15, we have that song which Moses composed following the crossing of the Red Sea. And much of the song is about the crossing of the Red Sea, but not all of it, not the last section of it. The last section, verses 13 to 18, looks forward. It's prophecy. Don't be fooled by the past tense that it's written in. It's written in the past tense because, like all God's prophecies, it's as certain as if it has already occurred. But it hasn't yet occurred. And it's a promise, then, of the Israelites enjoying God's abode. That word is used in verse 13 and in verse 17, and it's clarified further in the word sanctuary there in verse 17. And in what context, then, will this take place? God having an abode, a sanctuary into which the Israelites will be invited. Well, it's when they are finally planted. That's the word used in verse 17. Planted, that is, in the land of Canaan. Look at verse 15, middle of the verse. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them because of the greatness of your arm. They are as still as a stone till your people, O Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased. So the Israelites are going to come to the promised land. They're going to pass by the Canaanites, who will be paralyzed with fear, think Jericho and so on. And it's then, in that context, in Canaan, in the promised land, that God will erect his house among them and play the role of host. That's the promise, according to Exodus 15. That's the deal that God had signed up to. His commitment to dwelling hospitably among the Israelites related to that future era, beyond the wilderness period, beyond the entrance to and conquest of their inheritance. It related to them. Let me pause at this point and sketch an illustration. You have a friend, and one day your friend calls you and says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to save up a considerable amount of money. I'm going to buy a large plot of land in the Northumberland National Park, and I'm going to build a 10-bedroom mansion with its own cinema and hot tub, and I'm going to have you come and stay as my first guest there. Now, it may be that you know your friend is a bit of a dreamer. He's all talk. He often comes up with these idle fantasies, and so you don't take the whole thing very seriously. Or it may be that your friend is the kind of guy who stubbornly pursues all his pet projects, however ambitious, and gets them accomplished in the end, in which case, following that conversation, you look forward to the thing becoming a reality, perhaps 5, perhaps 10, perhaps 15 years down the line. But whichever of those two responses it is, whether skepticism or patient optimism, what you don't expect is this. You don't expect another call from your friend a few days later along these lines. Oh, you know that mansion that I was telling you about? How are you fixed to come and stay with me there the weekend after next? Look, I know it's too early for me to have saved up the money and bought the plot of land and undertaken the building project, but what's happening is I'm making a provisional, makeshift, lightweight version of the mansion that can be used immediately while all that other stuff is going on. It isn't in the Northumberland National Park. It's in a field that I borrowed from a farmer near Killingworth, but it's got all the bedrooms, it's got the cinema, it's got the hot tub. How are you fixed for the weekend after next? Well, you'd be staggered by that, wouldn't you? It would blow your mind. It would leave you speechless. What? That's extraordinary, you'd say. I've never heard of such a thing before. Surely there must either be a mansion achieved in the distant future or no mansion at all. There can't be a mansion in the distant future and a provisional version of it that's immediately usable. That just doesn't happen. Well, it's a situation a bit like that that we have here. God had promised he would erect his house among the Israelites in the distant future, in the land. But he's not content to wait until then. And you would think, well, surely he has to wait until then. He has no choice. Only in the land of Canaan is it even possible for him to erect his house among them. And yet, you see, extraordinarily, he comes up with this provisional, makeshift, lightweight version of his house that can be used immediately, even in the unlikely context of that desert journey. It's a wild, fantastical, completely out-of-the-box scheme. And you see what I mean then by that phrase, the God who delivers prematurely. He finds a way of delivering distant promises in the present, in some shape or form, at least. And you know, I would put it to you that if we could grasp that principle, it would make an enormous difference to our Christian lives. It's the principle, actually, that lies at the heart of a famous chapter in our Bibles, Romans chapter 8. In Romans 8:11, God promises that one day he will send his spirit upon us and flood us with resurrection life. It's talking about the last day, and our rotted remains will then be lying in some piece of earth somewhere. And God on that day will send his spirit, and in the language of that verse, give life to our mortal bodies. What a promise that is, isn't it? And I mean, that would be enough for us, wouldn't it? That will do us, that promise. We can cling to that. And that is a wonderful promise. We don't need anything more than that promise. On the last day, God will send his spirit upon us and flood us with resurrection life and give life to these mortal bodies of ours. But Romans 8 shows us something remarkable. It shows us that God is not content to wait until then. And so this is what he does. He sends his spirit upon us now, and he floods us with resurrection life in the present. And yes, it's a provisional makeshift version of it. It's not at this point physical bodies being made glorious like the physical body of Jesus Christ, but it's real nonetheless. Listen to Romans 8 verse 2. The spirit of life has set you free from the law of sin and death, he says there. Yes, the spirit of life is going to set you free on that day when he gives life to your mortal bodies. That's the main promise, but God delivers it prematurely. in the realm of our characters, our behavior, our thoughts and words and deeds, already the Spirit sets us free. Already he imparts resurrection to us. Do you realize that? Do you realize that in your home or in your workplace, tomorrow morning, you can live a resurrection existence? You can be pure. And you can be kind. And you can be honest, and you can be compassionate, and you can be loyal. And those things aren't natural to this old perishing age in which we live. They are the product of the Spirit sent upon you prematurely. Properly, he should give you resurrection life in the distant future, in the fitting context of the world to come, but he's given you a version of it now. In the unlikely context of this wilderness that you and I still inhabit, a resurrection life surging through your moral conduct, your lifestyle. Understand that, believer. Understand that. And seek to give full expression to your premature possession of resurrection life. Not yet in your body, but it's there. In your character, in your conduct. Express that. Live it out. Do it tomorrow. And so that's one principle. He's the God who delivers prematurely. And then the other principle, just to flag up, he's the God who desires participation. That's another principle, I think, that arises from this tent dwelling of God. He's the God who desires participation. We mustn't forget one simple fact here. The Israelites are dwelling in tents. The Israelites are dwelling in tents. And why then does God dwell in a tent during this period of Old Testament history? Well, yes, for the reason I've just outlined, but for another reason too. He desires to participate in their tently existence. Now you might be thinking, but the text doesn't say that, Dan. And no, it doesn't. Well, how do we know then? Well, we know because what we have here in this period of history is not a one-off. It's not a one-off. There are two key New Testament passages which describe our bodies during this life, as tents, interestingly. One is 2 Corinthians chapter 5. The other is 2 Peter chapter 1. In 2 Peter chapter 1 in the ESV, it's bodies that you'll find, but in the footnote you'll see in the Greek, it's actually tents. And that's an apt description, isn't it? Of our bodies during this life. I mean, tents are feeble and insubstantial things. We all have our stories, don't we, about fiascos involving tents. I think of one time when I was camping with some friends as a teenager, and it was a beautiful day, a beautiful evening, and so we decided just to put the outer layer of the tent up, not the inner layer of the tent. And anyway, in the middle of the night, I woke up. I've never been so disorientated in my life. I looked up and I could just see the stars. And I was like, well, what's happened to the tent? Where's it gone? Where am I? Have I been kidnapped or something? And I gradually realized that actually I'd just rolled out of the tent because it was just the outer layer. There's a kind of gap at the bottom. It didn't go all the way to the ground. And I just rolled out and I was sleeping alongside the tent. Or another occasion, we were camping in the queue at Wimbledon to get to the tennis. And in the middle of the night, someone came and sat on me from the outside of the tent. I was lying in the tent and someone came and sat on me from the outside. And so these are things that can happen in flimsy, frail, feeble tents. And our bodies are like that, aren't they? They're frail and feeble and flimsy. They get increasingly worn out as the years go by. They start to come apart at the seams until eventually they collapse altogether. But this is the thing. 1,500 years after the period that we're looking at here, God availed himself of one of those tents, even. He housed himself in one of those tents, the kind of tents that Paul and Peter are talking about in those passages. A human body. God the Son did that. I was listening to a podcast recently, and it was talking about one of the high-profile evangelical pastors who in recent years has sadly disgraced himself, not in this case so badly as some others, but disgraced himself nonetheless. And during this, they were interviewing a member of his staff in this mega church where he was pastor. And he was reminiscing about a trip that they'd gone on several years ago. So that the pastor himself, his high-profile pastor and his team, they'd gone to the Holy Land to film some programs there. And anyway, one night after filming, they'd driven back in the minibus, and kind of at a certain point, the minibus had stopped outside this astonishing resort, this five-star resort, very luxurious, very posh, very swanky. And the pastor had gotten out of the minibus, said, "Good night, folks," and then the minibus had driven on to the kind of downtown, very run-down hotel where the rest of the team were staying. And so this pastor then, I mean, he was happy to work alongside these guys. He got along with them. He would chat and laugh with them. But all of that, you see, it had a limit. There was a point where their ways parted. This is my existence in the posh, swanky hotel. That's your existence in the run-down hotel in the middle of town. And perhaps you're a Christian and you think of God like that sometimes. And yes, you know, he saved you, and in his grace he's favorably disposed toward you, but the relationship has a limit where the ways part. This is my existence, that's your existence. And the Bible says it's not so. Rather, we have a God who says, "I love you so much. I'm so devoted to you. I'm so interested in you. I'm so for you that I want to share in your very existence. I want to get right inside your very humanness even. A fellow camper with you under the flimsy canvas of a physical, finite body." What a God we have. A God who identifies, who participates to that extent. He's not content to be your savior from afar, maintaining a professional distance in the whole thing. No, he has this obsessive impulse to get as close as possible, to even inhabit your very situation, your very human nature. The God who desires participation. Well, that was the first point, and we spent longer on that then. We're looking at God's house, and we're saying in the first place, its composition is fabric and supports. And we've seen these two principles which arise out of that. But secondly, and much more briefly, its court is focused and spacious. Its court is focused and spacious. And this is chapter 27 then, verses 1 to 19. And verse 9 says, "You shall make the court of the tabernacle." Now, court can easily give us the wrong impression. We're not talking about a court in the legal sense here, or a court in the royal sense, certainly not a court in the sporting sense, a basketball court or something. The NIV courtyard is probably closer, as long as we don't think in terms of an unroofed area surrounded by buildings, which we perhaps often do with a courtyard. This is not surrounded by buildings, but it is a courtyard in the looser sense of an unroofed area that's enclosed. It's enclosed by all these hangings that are mentioned, and they're attached that are attached to pillars. So essentially then, with this court, we're talking about a rectangular space. Within the rectangular space toward the far end is the tabernacle, which, of course, is roofed. We've been talking about that. It's this roof tent. But all the rest of the rectangular space, apart from the tabernacle, which only actually takes a very small part of it, all the rest of this rectangular space is unroofed and enclosed, as I say, by these hangings. And it is spacious, then. That's one adjective that I used there in my heading. It's spacious in terms of sheer size. It's 100 cubits long. We read in verse 18, and 50 cubits wide, we read there too. So that's 150 feet by 75 feet. Roughly, this probably won't help you at all, but roughly the dimensions of an Olympic swimming pool, slightly smaller. And so it's spacious in terms of sheer size, and it's spacious in terms of being uncluttered. Apart from the tabernacle, which, as I say, takes up a relatively small part of it, there's hardly anything else in the court, in this rectangular space. And the spaciousness is necessary because this is the area then where the Israelites will come and they will participate in the sacrificial meals. They will eat. You know how you have that phrase in the Old Testament, eating in the presence of the Lord. Well, this is where that will happen. They will eat in this rectangular area in the court. So the adjective spacious makes sense. Why in my heading have I also used the adjective focused? What do I mean by that? Well, I'm using that word because although uncluttered, this court is not completely empty. There was one thing in it. There were two things in it, actually, but one is very small and isn't mentioned in this passage. It's not mentioned until chapter 30. There's a basin for the priests to wash their hands in. But there's one main thing in this court, and that is the bronze altar, then, that's described in verses 1 to 8 of chapter 27. So think of this room in the form it's in from Sunday night to Wednesday, when during term time, when baby and toddlers is on and the chairs are all cleared away and the room is empty. And imagine then there was just a hymn book lying somewhere in the middle of the room. Most of us probably entering the room would immediately notice the hymn book. Our eyes would be drawn to it. Why? Well, because the room is uncluttered and there's this one object. And when there's one object in a room, then your eyes are naturally drawn to it. The whole room would, in a sense, be focused upon that hymn book because it's the only thing. And it's like that then with this bronze altar in this rectangular space in the court. Of course, we're not talking about something the same size as a hymn book. This is quite a large thing. It's 5 cubits by 5 cubits, we read in those verses. That's 7.5 foot by 7.5 foot. So it's pretty big. But my point is the whole court is focused on that because it's more or less the only thing. Like that hymn book, it's more or less the only object. And so the whole court is focused on that altar. Why? Why? Well, I think answering that question takes us back to similar territory to where we ended our sermon last Sunday morning. Some of you will have read C.S. Lewis's book, The Silver Chair. And you'll know then that in The Silver Chair, you have these two children, Jill and Eustace, and along with their guide, Puddleglum, they are on this dangerous mission to find the lost Prince of Narnia. And at one point, the journey has been particularly heavy going, and they're battered and they're exhausted, and they come across Harfang. Harfang is a castle where giants live. But they've been told that the giants there are gentle giants, and it looks very warm and welcoming, and so they go up to the door of Harfang, and indeed they're welcomed inside. And initially they have a lovely time there, and they're fed, and they're able to have warm baths, and there's lots of fires that are on in the castle. And they discover, indeed, that everything's gearing up for an autumn feast. And this is very exciting. They're going to be at this autumn feast. And so they're having a great time in this castle of Harfang. But then one day they happen to be in the kitchen of the castle. And there's a recipe book that's open on the worktop. And it's open at a particular page. And the dish that's on this page of the recipe book, the main ingredient is children. And they suddenly realize that, yes, they are going to be at the autumn feast, but they're not going to be there as guests. They're going to be there as the dinner on the table. And they immediately have to try and think of some escape routes. So these welcoming giants then, they're going to turn on the children and eat them. Now, I emphasized last week that God's house is this inviting dwelling. There's a table there. There's a lamp there. It's an inviting dwelling. He wants his people to come in to it as his guests. But at the end of the day, he's this giant. He's this giant God, this colossal deity. What if, having invited them into the hat into his house, he then turns on them and devours them. Could any Israelite, I'm asking, really be at ease in that place? And the answer is yes. An Israelite could be at ease in that place. Why? Well, because wherever he was in that court, and that was the area, as I say, where the Israelites congregated, wherever he was in that court, his eye would keep being drawn to the bronze altar. That altar whose sacrifices pacified God and absorbed all his righteous anger against their sins. And can you and I then, as Christians, can we be at ease in the presence of God this morning? And the answer is yes, we can. Because we have an altar. Hebrews 13 verse 10 says that. We have an altar to focus our eyes on. It's a different shaped altar in our case. It's not a square one, 7.5 feet by 7.5 feet. It's a cross shaped altar. It's Christ's cross at Golgotha. An altar whose sacrifice has truly pacified God and absorbed all his righteous anger against our sins. And you come into God's presence and a doubt arises. You remember that sin on Thursday, on Tuesday, and you start to tremble. Can I really stand in the presence of God this morning? And then you look at the altar, you look at the cross, and you breathe again. It's okay. I'm safe. The anger of God has been absorbed. And it's not just in worship that this applies. It applies to life generally. And it applies to death generally. It's why we sing those words. We're not going to do so this morning because we probably will on Good Friday. Be near me when I'm dying. Oh, show thy cross to me. Thy death, my hope supplying, from death shall set me free. These eyes, new faith receiving, from Jesus shall not move. For he who dies believing, dies safely through thy love. Show thy cross to me when I'm dying. That's why when you sit with poor, weak, exhausted Ken by his bedside, there's a peace that radiates from him. Because he's looking at the altar. He's looking at the cross. And he's calm and he knows that his sins are dealt with. So believer, whether you're in the prime of life this morning or whether you can feel the path getting narrower as you enter into the valley of the shadow of death, make this your prayer. Oh, show thy cross to me. Show me the altar. Just as every Israelite's eyes were drawn to the altar, may my eyes be drawn to the altar. Show me it. Show me it when I'm feeling guilty. Show me it when I'm feeling downcast. Show me it when I'm feeling weak. Show me it when I'm at death's door. Show me thy cross, the altar that makes me safe, that means that the wrath of God I deserve will never, ever consume me. Show thy cross to me. Amen.